This is the European edition of Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show. We bring you the European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders innovating the rapidly evolving fintech scene today. A truly localized podcast with both English and local language content with some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in the fintech sector globally. Join us every week as we explore what makes the European Union a phenomenal proving ground for many of the fastest growing fintech plays in the world today. Okay, let's roll.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Breaking Banks Europe. Today is episode 66. Time flies when you're having fun and living in a global pandemic, it seems. We're starting off a new series on fintech apps or fintech more broadly. And it's kind of the 101 series. So today is our first one, and it is called CTO for Dummies. And this one is specifically CTO for Dummies, me being the dummy in this particular instance. We were having a conversation at the end of last year about what we wanted to know, what we wanted to share with our listenership. And I brought up the fact that, you know, I have worked for various fintech startups now. I work in product management, but I still have no idea what a CTO even really does. So we thought we would try and unpack it for you all with two of the best in the business. So I'm very pleased to have two guests today. Eric is joining us, who's a CTO of Movin, and Rajesh, who's joining us, CTO of Elvest, both based in the States, but that's okay. We'll forgive that one this time around. So Eric, if you want to go first and share a little bit about who you are, what your background is, and what you're working on now.
Sure, absolutely. So as you said, I'm the CTO at Movin. I've been with Movin since 2014. Prior to that, lived through several SaaS startups, software as a service, in a couple of different industries, in the InfoSec managed security space and in the customer service space. The customer service application, we had an exit to Microsoft in early 2014, was looking for a new challenge, and joined Movin at the time that we were really embarking on a net new business, which was jumping into the white label enterprise space from our early days as a challenger bank.
Amazing. Yeah, when I talk about Movin, I'm like, Movin's one of the OG challengers when I think about it. And Rajesh, thank you so much for joining us today. Same for you. I obviously, before you introduce yourself, funny story for our listeners. I met Rajesh about a year ago, or maybe more than that now. Time doesn't exist anymore. We met at, I think it was called Bodega or something. It was a little cafe bar in Santa Monica, of all places, while I was opening up Klarna's West Coast office. So we've actually met in real life briefly, but I'm so pleased to have you here today, Rajesh. Welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit more about you. Who are you? What's your background? And what are you up to today at Elvest?
Nina, thank you so much for having me on. As Nina said, we met a year and a half ago in Santa Monica. And you know, surprisingly, that was sort of a one-day recruiting trip that me and Sally Krajcek, who's the founder of Elvest, and one of our folks from PeopleOps came down. There was a group of candidates there who, you know, their earlier company had shut down, and we wanted to hire a bunch of them. And we ended up hiring three folks from there, and they've all been awesome. So that was the backstory there. My background has been in fintech. I'm right now the CTO at Elvest for about, you know, 4 years now. I joined Elvest in 2016, just as we were launching, and, you know, have been on this journey on our mission to essentially get more money in the hands of women. You know, that's the mission that Sally started the company with, and that's the mission that animates us. Myself, you know, I've been in fintech startups almost my entire career, and you know, I was at Zopa, which is based in the UK, and I founded my own company, co-founded my company, a SaaS company. For account opening called Oflows that went through a couple of acquisitions. And I started my career at Yodlee. So a broad range of fintech experience across payments, lending, banking, et cetera.
Wow. Yodlee, that is really a throwback. I feel like everyone has forgotten about Yodlee since Plaid has taken over the world. But maybe that's just me. So I guess the first thing that I wanted to talk about is, what is it even like to be a CTO today? And the reason that I'm bringing this up is, you know, I think we have reached this apex moment in fintech where, was it Marc Andreessen who said software is eating the world? It really is. Fintech is eating the world these days. And everything is fintech all of a sudden. You know, everyone loves the term embedded finance. We see all the tech players getting into it. But on top of that, you have so many, both of you come from software as a service backgrounds as well and have that experience. You have a lot of businesses coming out trying to be blank as a service. So we've got Stripe, who are, you know, payments as a service. Now we've got banking as a service, which is like all the rage. We've got KYC as a service and card issuing as a service. And we have all these parts now where really you could go about just stitching a bunch of APIs together to start some sort of B2C fintech. So I guess from your point of view, what is it like to be a CTO today? And maybe we'll start with you, Rajesh.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, being a CTO has shifted and evolved over time in my mind. You know, when I was co-founding the company with a couple of other co-founders, this was right after the financial crisis in 2009. And even before that, when I went in to become CTO at Zopa, the role of the CTO at that time was much more, you know, this was early stage. So it was much more, you had to be a strong programmer. You had to be able to stand a system up from a blank piece of paper. And in those days, it truly was a blank piece of paper. So you had to go out and find vendors and stitch them together in pretty convoluted ways in order to get something up and running. You know, I remember at Zopa when we were launching the US business, you know, getting credit reports, you had to go spelunking on how do you go get credit reports. You know, you can go really deep, directly connect with the credit bureaus, or you can have a layer on top. I think one of the key differences today is, as you said, you know, this evolution of various parts of the stack becoming as a service, you know, API-enabled, well-documented APIs. Mm-hmm. That makes the job a lot simpler. But in many ways, though the underlying plumbing is becoming simpler, the complexity of what we are building is increasing. So, you know, it's sort of this race. So even though the underlying plumbing becomes simpler, you're trying to build more and more complex things on top of that that evolving plumbing. So the job itself, you know, shifts over time, and it has shifted over time to be much more, you know, how do you piece these things together? How do you take into account not just, you know, building a piece of system up and running, but also how do you integrate all of these different vendors essentially in a way that you can have pretty reliable systems. And that's the other part of it. You know, the reliability expectations of software has just gone up mm-hmm. quite substantially. You know, 10 years ago, you could get away with sort of 99% uptime. You were good. You know, you would get vendor contracts with 99% uptime, and that was the norm. These days, you know, 99.9 is sort of expected. You know, you can be down several hours in a month. So the demands are increasing, but in terms of the capabilities that are available, that is also evolving. So it's a fun time to be a CTO.
Yeah, it's funny you say the downtime. I think about the fact that I think Chime recently went down again. And I remember when I worked at Starling Bank back then when our payment processor went down and we were all, you know, running around and trying to figure out, you know, do we have a SIP in place and all of this. And same thing happened to Monzo and Revolut. So there are other consequences when that comes to light. But Eric, anything from your perspective at Movin, where, as far as I understand, you did build that from the ground up.
We did, yes. I think the contrast there between where we are today and where we were 10 years ago isn't necessarily that we're stitching together systems and data that wasn't there before. It's really that the industry has evolved, the providers have evolved, the as a service providers that you highlighted have really kind of come together and standardized on, you know, modern web services as a delivery mechanism, which makes, you know, the lives of developers of fintechs that are trying to, you know, build something that's value added on top of these data sets much easier versus, you know, 10 years ago, we were, you know, ingesting data from platforms which were not exposed in, you know, friendly interfaces. So there was a lot of heavy lifting that was being done by engineering teams and by data teams to extract value from kind of siloed legacy systems. And I think that's been a huge enabler for the fintechs that are, you know, really focusing on consumer experience on top of these you know, value added data sets.
Yeah, I think about that quite a bit. Just to Rajesh's earlier point, the complexity kind of continues building. I was thinking, you know, just at Elvest alone, I think back to when we were talking about open banking in earnest a few years ago, and everyone was like, oh, transactional data is the key. It's the mother lode. It's everything we've ever wanted. And back then, there was this misconception that transactional data is going to be really nice and neat for you. It's not going to get messed up depending on the acquirer or the merchant name or anything. But really, merchant cleansing is like a big part of it. And then, you know, what you do with that then on, or one of the things that I love about Elvest is, you know, the algorithms that are being used are tailored specifically to a woman's life, which is different than most men, I would venture to guess. And so I completely hear both of you on the complexity kind of ramping up. Speaking of, though, one thing that I talk about quite a lot with my flatmate of all people is technical debt. And he is a data architect for the BBC. And so I'm always asking, he's like my go-to tech guy. And I'm always going to him and I'm saying like, what is this? What's that? What do you think about technical debt? Why do people talk about it so much? And I'm someone who very much thinks in metaphors. So after he, you know, took like an hour during dinner one day to explain to me, I came up with this metaphor, which I'm sure someone else has probably used before, of technical debt kind of in relation to gardening. Obviously, I've been in my flat for quite some time. I've got all these houseplants now. But I think about going in and kind of like pruning your garden and taking care of it and getting rid of, you know, dead leaves and all that sort of thing. So I'm kind of curious about, from your perspective, how do you think about technical debt in your organization? And obviously, that changes as the company grows. But maybe you can go ahead and start for us, Eric.
Yeah, so I mean, I love your metaphor there of kind of the maintenance and pruning in a garden. Another metaphor, and I think it's the clear metaphor that people are going for with technical debt is that debt metaphor, right? Mm-hmm. It's you go and take out a loan very intentionally to extend your ability, your purchasing ability. It's essentially the same thing in a technical world. And that's the way, or one way of thinking about managing it, right? It's, you have a choice in technology to invest a, you know, fixed number of resources, a fixed number of assets, whether it's money, whether it's engineering hours. And you have the choice to extend that purchasing power you know, by going into debt. And that debt might be, you know, making naive architecture choices up front, you know, choosing not to scale in the beginning because you know you don't know the entire problem space. And part of going into technical debt is recognizing that you have made that very pragmatic choice to defer or to bring in more assets in that purchasing model at the beginning, knowing that at some point in the future, you're going to have to pay that down. I think one thing, you know, just kind of jumping off of that into other concepts of technical debt is, you know, a lot of times people will think of technical debt just as that maintenance burden, right? You know, you go and you build software, and just by virtue of building software, you are incurring a certain amount of technical debt on the maintenance perspective because, you know, as soon as software is written, it starts aging and there's a maintenance burden that comes in. But that's not the only part of it.
I'd come in at it a different way, especially for startups. I think the concept of technical debt, it's a very powerful concept, that debt metaphor. But I'd also argue, especially for startups, when you're starting off, if you are not taking on a meaningful amount of sort of technical architectural debt, that is, if you are going for perfection or a great architecture from day one, you're probably doing something wrong. Because an important way of thinking about it is the first set of problems that you are solving as a super early stage startup, like, you know, if you're just starting off, is knowing whether customers are going to like your product. Whether it's B2B or B2C, that's your first problem. That's sort of the high order bit, right? It is understanding whether there is going to be demand for your product. So, you know, it goes back to the MVP thing, and the minimally viable product, almost by necessity, should have a meaningful amount of technical debt. You want to be smart about it. And that really cuts the heart of, you know, as a CTO, what you should be thinking about is, you know, how do you make that balance? You know, what architectural decisions are irreversible that's going to set you back, you know, by a long shot? And what architectural decisions can you, you know, sort of cut corners on in order to get the product to market sooner? So I think, you know, technical debt, you know, when you talk to some engineers, they'll think about it as always inherently bad. But it's really a trade-off, you know, just like everything else in engineering, it's, you know, technical debt is a trade-off. It's a trade-off you're making. And typically it's a trade-off you make for speed to market. And that's a good trade-off early on, but you have to switch the trade-off as the company matures, as the team grows. If you don't take care of it, then it can come and bite you, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the line.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting one, especially with the getting to market part. This is a conversation I've had before where, you know, if you have an idea, you want to get it out there and start validating it. And it's called an MVP for a reason. And I was speaking to a man who actually is a CTO over in Silicon Valley. And he was saying, you know, keep in mind all these things. I said, how do you feel about these low code, no code platforms these days? And I was thinking, maybe this is a good idea to launch an MVP. And he said, yeah, sure. I mean, if that's what works for you, if you don't have anyone with an engineering background to work with, but also keep in mind, you're probably going to throw the whole thing out. And I think for non-technical people, you kind of go, you know, gasp, shock, horror, the idea of chucking something out. And for me, as someone who has worked in different jobs where you go through like rigorous competitive analysis, and if you're choosing a vendor, you're so, you know, like, how long are we going to use this vendor? We're going to commit to it so long term. The idea of maybe yanking it out if it doesn't work or changing our mind down the road can be a bit daunting from my perspective.
No, it absolutely is, Nina. I think the notion of prototyping and build to throw one away, you know, it's been in computing for a long time, right? You know, Brett Brooks wrote about it in The Mythical Man Month, that you always have to build the first version of it so that you can throw it away. Mm-hmm. you know, and that goes to some of the complexity piece that I talked about, you know, especially with things like fintech. These days, if you're building a consumer fintech, you are, you know, you are integrating so many different pieces, and the pieces of the puzzle just fit so. Like, you know, you build the glue layer together, and the software that you're building in many cases in a B2C company tends to be the glue layer that integrates all these services. Mm-hmm. What does prototyping mean in those cases? You know, does it mean, you know, you have multiple vendors for each thing? That's a luxury that, you know, early stage companies cannot afford. And those are the kinds of, you know, decisions that you make tactically over time as a CTO. You know, when do you bring in sort of a second source vendor? And, you know, how do you build it in such a way that, you know, you're routing traffic appropriately and so on and so forth? So that's sort of the evolution. But it's not an easy question. You know, low code and no code is fantastic for initial prototyping, and I agree with that person that, you know, over time, if you're building software at scale, I don't think no code software has all of the capabilities that are there that are needed in order to build super robust systems at scale. But you know, the scale boundary of till when you can use low code or no code is increasing.
Yeah, I think the low code, no code environments, you know, it's a cyclical pattern in tech. You know, we've been through, you know, that first generation, right? They called it the fourth generation languages, that were, you know, really a hype cycle for low code environments. And they absolutely have their place. They're absolutely excellent for rapid prototyping, but there are edges to those systems. There are things that they're great at, and then as soon as you hit that edge, you're back into looking at an ecosystem where you really need to bring skilled software engineers to play. And the low-code environments almost are a chunk of tech debt that you've brought on, right? Because the engineers that you're going to bring in from the market are probably not as familiar with the low-code, no-code tools that you're looking at for rapid prototyping as they are with language ecosystems like the JVM or JavaScript or, you know, name your favorite language and framework. So that's kind of the way I look at those.
Yeah, I think the edge metaphor is awesome, Eric, because, you know, when you hit that edge where you need to actually crack open the code and actually look at it, the low-code or no-code platforms really fall apart in those cases, because at that point you're more or less back to square one if you need to build anything new over there, because modifying the code that the low-code platform is putting out is very, very hard. You know, this used to be in the Microsoft days, right? You know, it used to do a lot of boilerplate code generation, and you couldn't go in and modify any of that code. So it's, you're right, you know, it goes back and forth between this you know, fourth generation language and directly writing code.
Yep, absolutely. Well, the other part of it that I was thinking as you were talking earlier, Rajesh, is that one of the advantages that we're in now in the economic environment, in the software as a service environment, is that prototyping doesn't have nearly as much of a upfront risk as it had, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, because you're not going through the same vendor selection and acquisition process now because of these as a service, pay as you go kind of environments. So it's really easy to, you know, not necessarily commit to a long-term engagement with a vendor, spin up a prototype using some of these tools, and then get that MVP out, make adjustments, and not have a long-term commitment associated with, you know, that initial prototype.
Yeah, and that brings it to, you're absolutely right. I think the ability to switch vendors, you know, the one click away, and, you know, you try to kick the tires on the API and then see if it works out, that I think is a more meaningful change than most of the other technical side of things. Obviously, you know, not having to install software, spin it up, maintain it, and have somebody else deal with it is a big deal. But also, it pushes the onus on the vendors to continue to perform and not just rely on the fact that they have a 5-year contract to be sticky. So, you know, and that's a big reason why, you know, the evolution in some of the newer API stacks is so rapid because, you know, you almost have to be very in tune with the customer needs, which is the startup's needs.
Yeah, I think a practical example of that in the move-in lifecycle, we have over the last 10 years worked with probably half a dozen different sources of aggregated transaction data. And why do we change? Right, we change because there is value being brought by competitive entrants into that market.
Amazing. Well, on that note, we're going to go to a quick break. Stay with us, listeners. We will be right back after this short message.
The FTS Group builds innovation ecosystems. We engage incumbents, investors, entrepreneurs, technology partners, and regulators to build trusted and connected fintech tribes around the world. We firmly believe that innovation in financial services will truly improve people's lives. Learn more on ftsgroup.eu.
And welcome back from our short break. I am so excited to be here with Eric and Rajesh. I'm having a whale of a time nerding out, learning so much, using lots of mixed metaphors at this point, but that's how I learn best. This last part, we kind of wanted to dive into different types of CTOs and finding the right CTO. But I was very pleased to find that both of you have experience in both B2B and B2C CTO type roles. And so I guess, you know, the burning question is, what is the difference between being a B2B CTO and a B2C CTO or a B2B to C or whatever? So I'm not sure who wants to start with that question.
I'm happy to jump in and riff on it a little bit. My experience by far weighs more on the B2B side of things. But in the journey with MoveIn over the last 5-10 years, we've kind of moved around and targeted both the direct to consumer space as well as the B2B space. I think it beyond it being just a CTO commentary, it's an organizational concern. Looking at applying technology and product in a consumer space, your feedback, your ability to experiment is radically different than what you get in a B2B space. In a successful B2C environment, you have a lot more opportunity to do experimentation at a per user level and have that be something that is entirely within the control of your team. In the B2B space, especially in finance and working with large enterprises, your ability to experiment is kind of filtered through layers of relationship. And I think that's one of the things that jumps out, at least from my perspective, as a major difference between those two.
Hmm. Would you agree with that? Your thoughts on that, Rajesh?
Yeah, I think that's I think framing it around the speed of experimentation is one way of looking at it, and that's spot on. The other way I would think about it is in terms of practically what kinds of activities you do differently as a B2B CTO versus a B2C CTO. I think in B2C, you have to, especially if you're a fully online business, and that's the kind of stuff we're talking about in fintech. You're essentially looking at the full life cycle of all of the technology pieces, right? So you're looking at marketing technology, you're looking at, data analytics, you're looking at obviously the core full stack web or mobile application. So you're looking at all of the pieces of the puzzle as a B2C CTO. So you need to have, an understanding of how all these pieces fit together, how the marketing stack works with your funnel and understanding that is really important to have an impact on the business. But you don't typically spend a lot of time as a CTO with consumers directly. Yes, you do some user testing, and you're involved as a CTO in some of the user tests. But typically, you know, you're not going and doing presentations or, you know, explaining your product to your customers directly. On the B2B side, you're much more narrower in terms of the concerns that you're looking at. Yes, obviously, you know, the marketing concerns and the business concerns are important, but from a technology standpoint, you're really focused on building the core technology that you're selling to somebody else. But you are involved in a lot of different things. The customizability of the software, which is not super important in B2C, it's super important in B2B. Mm-hmm. The ability to, you know, explain the software architecture to your customers, that becomes very important in a B2B case, which is not as important in a B2C case. The putting together architectures and so forth. So the types of skills, the types of activities that you're doing as a B2B CTO versus B2C CTO is different. But at the core of it, the technical knowledge that is needed, the ability to, you know, read, write, understand code, hire people, those don't change. So there's a lot more in common, but there are enough differences between those two.
Well, and it makes me think of the earlier in the first part when we were talking about, you know, downtime. If your vendor goes down, that can be quite a bit of a panic if you've got millions of customers on the B2C side. But actually, if you are the B2B provider for that B2C, then that also causes a big problem because all of your clients are going to be down in the case of GPS and Starling or Galileo or whatever. So that's a very interesting.
If you're a B2B provider and you go down, you can be damn sure that your phone is ringing off the hook from your customers directly, right? Mm-hmm. Typically, you know, B2C customers, you know, there is another line of defense that is taking the brunt if you're down. Obviously, you know, you're burning the midnight oil if your site is down and you're fixing it. I think the stakes in a B2B provider at scale, you just have the problem just compounds.
Yeah, you look at the one way I look at it is, you know, those are two different buyer personas completely, right? An end consumer is looking for different things in a product than a B2B buyer. And a B2B buyer clearly has more experience entering into contractual relationships with other organizations than the typical B2C consumer. So we're talking about negotiating SLAs, we're talking about system security plans and capacity planning questions and things that a direct consumer customer is just never going to ask. So, you know, when thinking about, you know, who the right person is in a CTO seat in a B2B business, there's, you know, more sophistication from compliance and contracts, I think, than what you would look for in a direct-to-consumer CTO.
And the flip side of that, and that comes to the current sort of generation of, you know, fintech startups, which is, you know, you are piecing together so many different vendors in order to build your software. You have to get sophisticated about the contracting and compliance and SLAs on the other side of it as a buyer of these services.
Yep.
On the B2B side, you need to be sophisticated as a seller, but in the B2C side, because it's pieced together, you need to be sophisticated as a buyer.
And I think that brings us to a really interesting point about the evolution of the CTO. To your point, Eric, about having that mind for compliance or you know, just other aspects of the business. I think about the fact that when I was at Bud, you know, our CTO was going in and having conversations, not just with investors, but, you know, with banks to explain to them, like, this is how our tech works. And so there actually is, I mean, I'm from the Silicon Valley. Both my parents were QA engineers. There's this like stereotype of an engineer, like who's, you know, nerdy and in a hoodie and coding away. But actually, maybe the evolution of a CTO now is someone that actually needs to be able to not just have the knowledge of engineering, but also be able to go to an investor meeting, right? Or go to a client meeting and sell the product or be there and explain the complexities to the compliance team and how that's going to affect the way that they go and speak to regulators or the legal team and how they draw up contracts. So curious what you think on that, if those skills are increasingly needed today.
Well, I think I'm a little bit biased in that area because, you know, my first startup coming out of finance was in the InfoSec space. So risk, security, and compliance is kind of one of the things that I fall back to. And so I have a little bit of a, you know, mental tendency to go in that direction. My background really wasn't in hardcore software development starting out. So a little bit of the flip side of that engineer as the starting path to the CTO seat, more of a infrastructure and compliance background on my side. So I think there's value on both sides of that, right? And it's which areas do you have to focus in and which areas do you have to skill up in? So I've spent more time skilling up in, doing code review and understanding the code base over the years. But, you know, folks coming from the engineering seat have to skill up in the compliance space. They have to skill up in the infrastructure and scalability space.
Yeah, and my journey has been the opposite. You know, I started off as a software engineer and led bigger and bigger teams. So absolutely. I think the journey of skilling up in things like ability to read contracts, you know, negotiate SLAs, speaking to investors, those are all things that that required sort of learning and coming up the learning curve on those over the years.
I like that. I like the idea that we're always learning, though, no matter what, because I know I certainly am every day. Well, this brings me to our final question, which I think is kind of the gold mine for, especially for any students or aspiring founders here. But I guess one of the things for a lot of people who are non-technical is you're always in search of a technical co-founder. You hear that a lot. I remember even when Postmates went public, they were saying like, oh yeah, he really went and found two code monkeys, which don't love the language there, but you know, went and found two guys to code this thing together because he didn't have the technical prowess to do so. I mean, oftentimes I've met tons of founders who are non-technical and they're like, right, I really need to find someone who is technical. And so that begs the question, what should someone look for when they're hiring their first CTO or hiring for a CTO? And for both of you having been in that position, if you were hiring for your own role, what would you be looking for?
I think it depends upon what stage, right? And the CTO role definitely evolves over time, not just, you know, over time in the industry, but within the company it evolves over time. So if you're starting off and you're looking for a technical co-founder, I think as a founder, you want to be thinking about, you know, what is the type of technology that we need to build? I think, you know, I speak to a number of non-technical founders and, you know, there is a tendency to sort of think about everything all at once. I think that's a counterproductive way of thinking about it, right? You know, they'll talk about, you know, machine learning and, you know, and artificial intelligence and like, you know, at scale, we are going to do all of these things. But that's not the type of person you want to hire from day one. You don't need an artificial intelligence expert if you're building sort of a transaction categorization product. Yeah, not a categorization. You know, if you're building sort of a initial payment product or whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. If you're building a transaction categorization product, you probably need the machine learning expertise. So you, as a founder, you want to be sure about what is that first initial product that you want to build. You want to have a good idea. And look for a person who can build that, execute on that. And, you know, if that person comes with broader skills, that's great. And I think that's the kind of person you want to be looking at. Can this person scale over time? But a person who cannot get the initial 6, 12 months of what needs to be done, then you're in for trouble, right? You have this person who can operate a 100-person organization, engineering organization, but not really capable of doing it from the ground up, rolling up their sleeves and writing code. So I think you know that's important to have that balance. So and that's why it's important to think about when you're getting in, when you're starting a company, the key thing that a CTO brings is the ability to ship the first version, right? Maybe the first couple of versions of software. So you need somebody who's strong and able to do that. And now, depending on the type of company you're building, that may be different, right? You know, from day one, if you're going into enterprise sales, you need somebody who can go talk to enterprise customers, right? If you're building something in the compliance space, for example, you definitely need that from day one. But if what you're building is sort of a B2C app, you probably don't. So you want somebody who's a strong programmer, who can do good mobile development or whatnot. So I think that's what you look for on day one. And then over time, that role scales, right? That role changes over time, as we talked about. You know, as you get to Series A, Series B, the role shifts. And then, you know, there's also this whole thing around VP of engineering versus CTO. You know, some companies split that up over time. It makes sense. So I think, you know, at every level, the role of the CTO changes. But on the day one, you want somebody who can ship product the first couple of versions of it.
Yeah, and I think the other piece is definitely understand the stage that you're at. Understand that the startup CTO is probably not the same as the exit CTO. You know, sometimes that happens, but I would say that across a portfolio of companies, that founding CTO or founding VP of engineering or founding tech co-founder may not be the person that's going to be driving that CTO seat at a point where the company has scaled up. So you're recognizing that person is somebody that is going to be responsible for building a team and potentially transitioning leadership of that team to a future version of himself is, I think, a thing that a lot of people don't necessarily consider day one. So there's definitely some egos involved in this. I've seen that go badly and I've seen it go well, but, if you start off with that assumption that, we're hiring for a role that, has the potential to, eventually replace itself. I think you're starting off from a better position.
Nina, the other way to think about it is, if you're going in sort of, equal partners or whatnot, I'm not talking about equity split. I'm just talking about, if you're truly partners, then, you can look for somebody who has operated at a higher scale and who is ready, willing, and able to roll up their sleeves and write code, right? That is sort of the holy grail, if you may. Not always easy to find. But if you can find such a person that'll be a huge win.
Amazing. Well, listeners, you heard it here first. We've got the two best in the biz telling you what to look for. So we should be charging for this episode, honestly. Well, this has been a phenomenal educational experience for me, but just lovely speaking to you both. It's a bit more intimate than our normal episode, so I'm really glad that I got you both to myself today. As we wrap up, I just want to thank you again for joining. And also, I guess as we sign off, any parting shots, where can our listeners find out more about you, about Elvest, Rajesh?
Yeah, you can go to www.elvest.com, ELLEVEST.com. We have a money membership product that everybody in the US should sign up for, download the app and use it. It's pretty awesome.
Amazing. And Eric, where can our listeners find out more about you or Movin or what you're up to?
Absolutely. Come visit us at www.movin.com. If you're in a market where we have a white label app in place, you can visit the app stores and download the apps and check it out. In Canada, that's the TD MySpend app. And over in New Zealand, that's Westpac's CashNav. Indonesia has a couple of different options. Definitely go check it out.
Love to hear it. Well, thank you again, gentlemen, for joining me today. It's been wonderful, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon. All right, that's a wrap.
Thanks for listening to Breaking Banks Europe, a Provoke Media podcast in cooperation with FinTech Stage. Don't forget to tweet us out, shout out, or post to the team at Breaking Banks EU on Twitter. If there's something or someone you'd like to hear on our cast, let us know. See you next week on Breaking Banks Europe.